pay for the very thing that I wouldn't allow you to participate in. This has been Higher Ground
indeed.
Brother A-Dub, Sister Carol Grant for the people. And as John Lee Johnson used to say, stay out of trouble. But as Paul Muth says, and I agree, and the late John Lewis said, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
Hey. Paul Muth.
Hey, I'd like to hear my Terry. I'd like to hear him a lot. I remember when he was doing such great work around the time of the graduated income tax battle,
yes. Yeah.
Which we know failed with a lot of money came out to oppose it. Let's see. And how they got me on a mailing list emphasizing more deputies on patrol in their targeted mailing, it's beyond me. It must have been after the person stole my public safety poster from my they wouldn't have been doing that. I don't know if they checked Google Earth or anything like that. Anyway, opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. My name is Paul Muth. This is News from Neptune, and gonna give most of the hour over to Chris Hedges and John Mersheimer, because on the day of the earlier than, maybe it was the day before the attack on Iran by Israel. Well, they attacked Syria and Iraq too. And I haven't heard much discussion about it. How they did it, was it all missile volleys? There's some idea and not discussion that I heard that Saudi Arabia didn't lie on the overflight as it did Jordan, none of the neighboring states that helped them fight off the previous October 1st attack by Iran, cycle of escalating violence. No Mumia Abu Jamal commentary. It's been quite a while since had one. And trying to find the title of the YouTube video. I didn't have time.
Overreach is.
There's Chris Hedges. Escalating crisis in the Middle East dropped just a day ago, and I guess it was the day that later in the day the attack happened. So Amy's got a pretty heart-wrenching commentary, as often is the case these days. Our tax dollars at work. I didn't get up real often and check the news like I do sometimes, but I still slept poorly. It's been several nights of it. One night I was insomniac and I kept thinking, Hitler's generals. Trump saying that he needed more generals like Hitler had? I mean, incompetent that they bluff. They weren't able to blow him up and assassinate him. They wanted incompetent ones. That's my middle of the night. Discourse, I guess. And okay, here's the right file. Sorry, I'm slow starting and low functioning. I'm going to have to be quick on the draw too, because YouTube seems to be dropping even more ads, and in the middle of a paragraph, in the middle of a sentence sometimes. So I apologize for that, but didn't have the time to dub this and edit it since the attack just happened yesterday, and the just before that, Chris Hedges dropped the interview with John Mersheimer from University of Chicago. Don't say a word about Ukraine, I don't think. It's all about Gaza and the escalating crisis. All right, here's Amy.
Teens are being burned in Gaza, often with U.S. weapons. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Last February, Shaban Al-Dalou, a student at Gaza's Al-Azhar University, made an online plea to the world.
Hello from the tent where we reside. I'm Shaban Ahmad, 19 years old. I'm a student studying software engineer. In this barbaric starvation war, we have displaced 5 times so far. Now we are in Al-Aqsa Memorial Hospital in the middle of Gaza, Deir el-Balah. I'm taking care of my family as I'm the oldest. I have 2 sisters and 2 little brothers and my parents.
For over 6 months up until last week, Shaban and his family had been living in a tent near Gaza's Al-Aqsa Hospital. In the early hours of Monday, October 14th, Israel bombed the crowded makeshift camp, setting many tents on fire. The tent that Shaban built with his own hands became his funeral pyre. Horrific video footage of the attack went viral, showing Shaban leaning up in his bed, raising his arm with an intravenous drip still attached, being burned alive. His mother was also incinerated, and several other family members grievously burned. It was just days before Shaban's 20th birthday. In the following days, his younger brother, Abdul Rahman, and his sister, Farah, both died of their wounds. His death only amplifies the tragedy of his earlier plea for funds.
We live in a very hard circumstances, suffering from various things, such as homelessness and limited food and extremely limited medicine. And the only thing between us and the freezing temperature is this tent that we constructed by ourselves. I made this campaign to restart a new life in Egypt and evacuate. Thank you.
In the video, an Israeli drone whines overhead, a constant reminder that no place is safe in Gaza. Shaban, Abdul, and Farah were just 3 of Israel's victims in what's increasingly been described as a genocide. Estimates of the death toll range from just over 42,000 to as high as 300,000 Palestinians killed during Israel's year-long assault on Gaza, following Hamas's surprise attack on Israel on October 7, 2023. Of course, none of this violence would be possible were it not for the unfettered support that the United States gives to Israel with tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons, diplomatic cover, and now with troops on the ground. Abu Bakr Abed, a young Gaza journalist, lives near the scene of the attack that killed Shaban. He shared his reaction speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
We are about the same age. He memorized the Quran. I memorized the Quran. He dreamt of completing his studies. I also dream of completing my studies. And our message is very clear from here. We are young men that have nothing to do with this war. We're not a party to this war. We have no connection with Hamas. But we are very daily being subjected to sheer violence and brutality that is nothing to do with this war. It just keeps going and on. And without any stop, even after the news of the killing of Hamas leader, there seems to be no stop, and which is incredibly devastating for us. What more should we really endure and go through so this war can stop?
B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, says the international community must take action to force Israel to stop its assault, especially given its latest siege on northern Gaza, now entering its 4th week.
This is ethnic cleansing.
Sarit Mikhaeli, B'Tselem's international advocacy lead, said on Democracy Now!
All this indicates one clear goal, which is to remove the people from northern Gaza, to empty that area. We also called last week on the international community to really take responsibility for what is going on in Gaza. And we stated openly, that it's not just Israeli policymakers who should be held accountable and face consequences for these crimes, but also that the international community cannot but be considered complicit if Israel goes ahead and empties North Gaza of its inhabitants.
Mikhaeli says Israel's
absolutely horrific plan, it includes provisions that are absolutely and clearly war crimes and could probably also be viewed as crimes against humanity.
If these crimes weren't enough, Israel's also violating U.S. law, using arms from the U.S. against a civilian population and directly preventing U.S. humanitarian aid shipments from reaching their intended recipients. Yet the Biden administration seems unwilling to put a stop to Israel's unrelenting and illegal attack on the Palestinians trapped in Gaza. Secretary of State Antony Blinken just finished his 11th trip to Israel over the last year. Blinken and U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin sent a letter to Israel on October 13th, threatening that a failure to increase humanitarian aid into Gaza within 30 days may result in a halt in arms shipments to Israel.
Nowhere in the law does it say, you know, give them 30 days to see if they can fix it.
Josh Paul, a former State Department official who managed arms transfers, then resigned over Biden's Gaza policy, said on Democracy Now!, "For Shaban and so many others, it's too late. But for the living in Gaza, including those held hostage, there must be a ceasefire now." I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, when Blinken gave that sternly worded letter, he insisted on 500 trucks a day about what was going into Gaza prior to this, and that's, it wasn't even enough then. They sent 50, and Blinken did not go on record after that, as far as I know. Okay, we're going to go to Chris Hedges for the rest of the show, and like I said, I'm doing this directly from YouTube, and I'm going to have to intercept some ads and drop in some announcements or extemporize or something. There's one place where I do have something that I will mention for sure, if I can remember. Thanks for listening, and you can find this on YouTube. This one, it's the Chris Hedges Report. He was a New York Times reporter in Israel for at least a 5 or 6 years, I guess, so he knows the terrain. And John Mearsheimer is at University of Chicago, the escalating crisis in the Middle East. And again, it was recorded or put up early in the day that the attack happened. So there'll be some, but not many actual anachronisms in it.
There are very few political scientists endowed with the brilliance and courage of Professor John Mearsheimer, the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago, where he has taught since 1982. He graduated from West Point in 1970 and served 5 years as an officer in the U.S. Air Force. He has written extensively about security issues and international politics, including in his books Conventional Deterrence, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which he co-authored with Stephen Wald from Harvard, and The Great Delusion, Liberal Dreams and International Realities. He has been a prescient critic of the follies of late empire, the insidious and corrupt workings of the Israel Lobby in the American political system, and the fiasco in Ukraine. Joining me to discuss the conflagration in the Middle East, the overreach by Israel and the United States, and the consequences of this overreach for regional and global stability is Professor Mearsheimer. Let's begin with the Israel Lobby, because it's relevant to everything that's happening. I remember your great book that you did with Walt. You took a lot of heat for this. Not as controversial today. I mean, I think it's a kind of recognized truth. But the fact that the Israel Lobby has essentially bought the U.S. Congress, which means that it has bought endless supplies of military aid and given it a kind of impunity to engage in overreach, is, I think, being evidenced now. I mean, what Israel is fighting, in essence, on five fronts. So let's talk about the lobby and how it has affected regional stability and Israeli policy.
So I've had solar for about 2 years now, and I'm very happy with it. My neighbors pay an average of about $80 to $100 a month for electricity.
Well, at least that wasn't mid-sentence. Well, the WEF fundraising drive is officially over, but you can always donate, and there are still some T-shirts at $90.1. You can look for the blue donate button on the WEF.org site and take care of that. And there was one other thing that I was supposed to drop in, so why don't we do that now? Maybe there won't be as many ads as when I was previewing this. And that's an underwriting announcement.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible in part by Bash Pepper Roofing. Large or small, they cover them all, commercial or residential. Bash Pepper Roofing offers roofing and re-roofing, gutters, siding, and door needs. For more information, 217-352-2200 or online at bashpepper.com.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott County.
Well, that's the one I should have played. It's not going so well here. So Halloween is being celebrated in downtown Champaign today. Spooky Saturday from 3:30 to 5:30. Weather's pretty good for it. There's a number of businesses in downtown that are happy to have you come by, and I'll tell you that maybe later.
And we'll back them anyway. And this is what you see at play today. So, you know, when people talk about Israel's wars in the Middle East, you know, the war in Gaza against the Palestinians, the war in Lebanon against Hezbollah, and the war between Israel and Iran, you're really talking about a war that involves the United States and Israel joined together at the hip. We're deeply involved in these conflicts. Fortunately, we don't have soldiers on the ground who are dying. Of course, we now have some soldiers on the ground in Israel, but not many. But the fact is that we are supplying the Israelis with all sorts of arms, all sorts of diplomatic support, and we allow them to do pretty much anything they want. And this has huge consequences for the region. It certainly has huge consequences for the Palestinians, and it has huge consequences for the United States.
Let's talk about some of those consequences. Israel is, of course, been bombing in Lebanon. It's been bombing in Syria, Yemen, not to mention its saturation bombing of Gaza. Remember, Gaza is a very tiny place, 20 miles long, 5 miles wide, virtually decimating Gaza. But let's talk about the consequences of that. When Israel waded into Lebanon in 1982, it didn't go very well for them, despite their overwhelming firepower.
Well, let's just talk about the Lebanon war, then we can talk about Gaza. They're obviously fighting against Hezbollah because Hezbollah is supporting Hamas, and it's supporting Hamas by firing rockets and some missiles into northern Israel. And the end result is somewhere between 60 and 70,000 Israelis have had to flee the northern part of Israel and move temporarily into the center. And the Netanyahu government, unsurprisingly, is deeply committed to getting those people back to their homes in the north. So it wants to stop Hezbollah from firing missiles into northern Israel. Hezbollah says the only circumstance under which we'll stop firing those missiles is if you stop the war or the genocide in Gaza. And the Israelis, of course, refuse to do that because they're bent on ethnically cleansing Gaza. So the end result is the Israelis have to figure out another way to deal with Hezbollah. And the first strategy they employed was decapitation. And of course, they killed Nasrallah and a number of other high-ranking Hezbollah officials. And that had no real effect. then they decided they were going to start pummeling the cities and towns in southern Lebanon and Beirut as well, and kill lots of people. And that this punishment campaign would hopefully get Hezbollah to throw up its hands and quit. That hasn't worked either. So they've then pursued a third strategy, which is to invade southern Lebanon with ground forces, which is what they have been doing for the past few weeks. This isn't working either. And if you read the Israeli press every day, you see that Hezbollah is continuing to fire, you know, 135, 140, 150 rockets into Israel every day. So they're not solving the problem. And I would add to that, they're not solving the problem in Gaza, and they're not going to solve their problem with Iran by using military force. So all of this is to say that the Israelis are in deep trouble, and because we're joined at the hip with the Israelis, we're in deep trouble too.
You say deep trouble. Let's spell that out, what it means, what deep trouble means for Israel and what deep trouble means for us.
Well, just let's talk about the Israelis to start with. Israel has always emphasized that the last thing it wants to do is fight a protracted war, a war of attrition. And what it wants to fight instead are quick wars that last 6 days, like the famous Six-Day War in 1967. Furthermore, the Israelis have long emphasized that they want to be capable of fighting those wars all by themselves. They don't want to have to depend on another country. Well, if you look at what's happening today, they are involved, in my opinion, in three separate wars that show no signs of ending, that have been going on for at least a year. And this means that the Israelis are in real trouble because they can't win this set of wars quickly and decisively. Furthermore, it's very clear, if you look at how the conflict is being waged, that the Israelis are highly dependent on the Americans. They're not only dependent on the American industrial base for weaponry, they're also dependent on American military forces to help them fight their enemies. You want to remember that on April 14th, when Iran attacked Israel, that the United States played a key role in helping Israel defend itself against Iran's missiles and drones. And we are expecting any day now another attack by Israel against Iran, and then Iran is expected to retaliate. Well, if Iran retaliates, we now have more forces than ever in Israel to help Israel defend itself. Why? Because Israel itself cannot fight off the Iranian missile attack. So you have this very interesting situation where not only can Israel not win these wars that it's fighting, but they've turned into protracted wars, and they're protracted wars in which Israel is heavily dependent on the United States. All of this is to say they're in serious trouble.
And what are the consequences of that, ultimately? I mean, of course, Israel would like to displace or ethnically cleanse the Palestinians in Gaza into the Sinai, but the Egyptian military is just in Egypt, has been categorical to Sisi that is never going to happen. We know the intent, but can they really push the people out of Gaza? And although they are in big trouble, they're on the verge of annexing northern Gaza. They put it under siege. The 400,000 Palestinians are being slaughtered, starved. I mean, it does seem that that incrementally they are moving towards what it is they want.
I think you can make that argument. I think that it's clear that they're not interested at the moment in cleansing all of Gaza, that they're focusing mainly on northern Gaza. Tony Blinken was in Israel yesterday, this is Tuesday, and he told the Israelis, and he was speaking here to Netanyahu and his lieutenants, the word was out that they were trying to ethnically cleanse northern Gaza and push all the Palestinians into the southern part of Gaza. And he made it clear that that was unacceptable. The Israelis, of course, denied that they were doing that, when in fact the evidence is overwhelming that that's exactly what they're doing. And the question then is, can Blinken or Biden bring pressure to bear on the Israelis to get them to change their behavior? And the answer there is almost certainly no. So I think there will be significant cleansing of northern Gaza, but that doesn't mean the Palestinians will be driven completely out of Gaza. They'll still be locked in Gaza, just in a smaller space. And the question is, where does that leave the Israelis? They're still running Gaza. And at the same time, one does not want to underestimate the damage that's being done to Israel's reputation. This is a moral stain on Israel that is not going to go away for the foreseeable future. It's not going to go away for a long time. Israel is going to be widely seen as a country that has committed genocide in Gaza. And this is going to do huge damage to Israel's reputation moving forward. And furthermore, it's going to do huge damage to America's reputation, because we are widely seen as being joined at the hip with the Israelis. We are complicit in this genocide. And this is going to have long-term consequences.
Well, explain, I just want to make two points. 1973, Israel depended massively on U.S. support because so much of their own armor and everything was wiped out. You had C-130s landing in Israel every 30 minutes, courtesy of Henry Kissinger, to resupply the military. That's number one. Number two, in terms of lying to the Americans, go back to 1982. The Americans begged Israel not to bomb West Beirut, and Israel just did it anyway. These are just patterns that we have seen vis-a-vis the relationship with the United States.
Chris, there is absolutely no doubt that the Israelis are able to do whatever they want, whether you're talking about 1982 or the present, and there's not much we can do to stop them. Again, this is the power of the lobby. The lobby insists that the United States provide Israel with unconditional support, no matter what it does. So if the Israelis disobey us, we just, you know, bite our tongue and go along with it. It's just the way it works. So you're correct on that point. With regard to weaponry, there's no question that the Israelis have always depended on us for weaponry. And before they depended on us, they depended heavily on the French. So there's no question they've gotten outside support in terms of providing them with weapons. But what I was talking about is actually helping them to fight their wars. You want to understand that the Israelis need us in the fight at this point in time. We have lots of assets in the Middle East at this point in time, lots of assets in the Eastern Mediterranean and in Israel itself and in the Red Sea that are all designed to fight to help Israel in its various wars. And this includes not just Iran. It also includes the Houthis. It includes Hezbollah as well. So we are deeply involved in helping them fight in ways that was not the case in 1973 or any time before this war.
So let's look a little bit at the consequences for the United States. I mean, first of all, we have 20 years of military fiascos in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, which is, to put it mildly, alienated the Muslim world. It was 1.5 million, billion Muslims, and much of the global South. So we are, and then we have had all the scandals of Abu Ghraib and drones gunning down civilians, etc. So our situation is certainly within the Middle East already precarious. What happens now? I mean, you said that it's bad news for the United States. Lay out the consequences.
Well, if you think about what's happening at a macro level, what you see is that the United States has pushed China and Russia and North Korea and Iran very close together. They form a very tight-knit bloc at this point in time. Largely as a result of the Ukraine war, the Russians and the Chinese have been driven together. And given what's happening in the Middle East, the Iranians and the Russians have been drawn together. So the United States may be helping Israel, but it's important to understand that the Russians are helping Iran as well. And this situation is not to our advantage. It's not to America's advantage to have China and Russia aligned closely against Washington. It's not in America's interest to have Russia and Iran working together against Israel and the United States. There's always the possibility that if a war heats up involving Iran on one side and the United States and Israel on the other side, that at some point down the road that the Russians will get dragged into that war because the Russians now have a vested interest in supporting Iran. This is not to our advantage. Then there's the whole issue of nuclear proliferation. One of our principal concerns over time, and this, of course, is one of Israel's principal concerns as well, is to make sure that Iran doesn't get nuclear weapons. Of course, Iran has the capability to produce a bomb actually quite quickly. It has enough fissile material that it could do that. And we, by allowing the Israelis to bomb Iran and get into this fight with Iran, are giving the Iranians very powerful incentives to get a bomb, to throw aside their non-nuclear status and become a nuclear weapons state. And if that happens, the Saudis have said that they would acquire nuclear weapons. And if the Saudis acquire nuclear weapons and the Iranians have nuclear weapons, surely the Turks, the Iraqis, and the Egyptians won't be far behind. So for purposes of limiting or capping nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, which is a very important goal for us, Israeli behavior is undermining our policy on that front. So these are just two ways in which our support of Israel is working to hurt us.
And yet there's been a long reticence among U.S. policy figures, as well as the Pentagon, to any kind of a confrontation with Iran, going all the way back to the Bush administration, when Netanyahu was pushing the same agenda, war with Iran.
I mean, what's really amazing here, Chris, is that the Iranians don't want a war with us, and we don't want a war with Iran. It's very clear. It's the Israelis who are trying to bait us into a war. You want to remember that what got all of this started was that on April 1st, the Israelis attacked the Iranian embassy in Damascus. And the Iranians then retaliated on April 14th against Israel. And then Israel had a minor retaliation on April 19th. And at that point, it looked like we had shut things down and we were going to avoid a war between Israel and Iran, and certainly between Iran and the United States, which is what we wanted and the Iranians wanted. Then on July 31st, the Israelis killed Ismail Haniyeh, the Palestinian or the Hamas leader, in Tehran. They actually struck in Tehran. This was on July 31st. In response, unsurprisingly, on October 1st of this year, the Iranians launched about 180-plus ballistic missiles at Israel. And now we're waiting for Israel to retaliate. And then, of course, the Iranians have made it clear they're going to counter-retaliate. And then the Israelis will probably counter-retaliate. So what's happening is we're going up the escalation ladder. And at the same time, the United States has pledged itself to help Israel defend itself. We did this on April 14th in the first round. We will do it again on October 1st, and we'll do it again if there's a counter-retaliation by Iran. So you can see we're inexorably being pulled into this conflict between Israel and Iran that we don't want and Iran doesn't want. But again, we just have remarkably little leverage over Israel's behavior, in large part because the Israel lobby protects Israel.
Why does Israel want a war with Iran? Israel pushed for a war with Iraq to essentially destroy the power base. Saddam was a major regional power. They succeeded largely, although Iraq is dominated by Shias, Iran is Shia. They're very closely allied now. But why Iran? Iran's not Lebanon. It's a completely different animal.
Well, I think that the Israelis believe that they alone cannot take out Iran's incipient nuclear weapons capability. But the United States and Israel working together can do that. And I think they'd like to drag us in so that we can eliminate the Iranian nuclear capability once and for all. This is a pipe dream. It's not going to happen, even if the United States is involved. But many Israelis seem to believe it. The second point is they view regime change in Iran as feasible. They think that we, the United States and Israel, can inflict enough pain on Israel, maybe even execute a decapitation strategy. And the end result is that the existing regime in Iran, which is hostile to Israel for sure, will disappear and you will get a friendly regime and we will live happily after, happily ever after. This too is a pipe dream. And then third, and not to be underestimated, is I think the Israelis want a general conflagration in the region because that's the best way to do ethnic cleansing in Gaza and in the West Bank. There have been two big instances of ethnic cleansing in the past. One was in 1948 with the infamous Nakba, and the second was in 1967, mainly on the West Bank in the context of the Six-Day War. The Israelis understand full well that if you have a general conflagration, people will not be paying much attention to the Palestinians, and people will be willing to give Israel more of a pass than they would in peaceful times. So let's really ramp things up. Let's have a general conflagration. And the end result will be that we can cleanse on a massive scale in Gaza and hopefully in the West Bank as well.
Let's talk about air power.
Various reasons I'd point to.
Let's talk about air power. So Israel has used air power as well as artillery and tank rounds and naval bombardment to obliterate the infrastructure in Gaza quite effectively. It relies primarily on air power to attack Lebanon. It again with massive destruction. It of course used its air power to bomb the consulate in Damascus that killed senior Iranian officials. And I assume that it is going to rely, perhaps with U.S. support, on air power to go after Iran. The idea that there would be, I don't know how, what your position on this, I mean, do we reach a point where air power has limits? You're a former Air Force officer, so you can, you know, explain that far better than I can. But there's only so much you can do with air power. Do you foresee the possibility of ground troops going? Iran's a huge country. What's the population? 90 million or something. Where do you see that going? And talk a little bit about both the use of air power and its limitations.
Well, air power, the way the Israelis used it, is employed for two different purposes. One is decapitation. And two is what you were describing, Chris, which is a punishment campaign. Basically murder in huge numbers of civilians on the premise that if you kill enough civilians, they will put great pressure on their government to throw up their hands and accede to Israeli terms, or maybe even overthrow the government. We have a very rich literature in international relations that shows, number one, decapitation does not work. And in fact, Israelis have been decapitating Arab leaders for a long, long time, and it has not worked. And furthermore, we have a huge literature in international relations that shows that punishment campaigns don't work. You can go back to World War II to find plenty of evidence to support that. You can go back to the Vietnam War to find plenty of evidence to support that. You can kill huge numbers of civilians, and rarely, if ever, do the civilian populations rise up against the government or put pressure on the government to change its behavior? So air power is a tool of greatly limited utility for Israel. I mean, the Israelis like to use the tool because it doesn't involve many Israelis, if any Israelis, getting killed. It's not like sending ground troops into southern Lebanon, where lots of Israeli soldiers are going to die. They'd much prefer to use air power. But the problem is it just doesn't buy you that much in the end. There's no question that the amount of destruction that the Israeli Air Force causes is great. But whether or not it produces success as defined by Israel is another matter. And there the answer is quite clear. Now, you raise the issue, given this situation, will we put ground forces in Iran? I would just go back to my discussion earlier, Chris, of Lebanon. Remember, I said the Israelis first tried decapitation, then they tried punishment, and then they sent ground forces into Lebanon. So I think your sort of intuition that maybe they'll think about doing this with regard to Iran is on the money. That's the pattern we saw in Lebanon. But I find it almost impossible to imagine that the Israelis and certainly the Americans would put ground forces in Iran. That would be really asking for trouble. That is, as you pointed out, a huge country with a big population, and we would get ourselves into serious trouble. You know how much trouble we got into in Iraq when we went in there in 2003. This
well,
would
just to interrupt, it would be seen as a war against Shiism. So Iraq is primarily Shia, about 60%. It would you would certainly have an alliance with other Shia groups outside of Iran against any kind of direct American intervention.
You know what's interesting, Chris? You know, oftentimes we distinguish between Shias and Sunnis, and we emphasize the cleavage there. But I would note to you that there are only two groups on the planet that have really come to the aid of Hamas. And Hamas is mainly comprised of Sunnis, of course. But one is Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is a Shia organization.
Right. That's right.
So this is Shia coming to the aid of Sunnis in Gaza. And the Houthis. And the Houthis are mainly Shia.
Yeah.
I think what's going on here is that Israel's behavior is so horrible. It's so terrible what they're doing. And America's support of that behavior is so horrible, so terrible, that what's happening is that the divide between Shia and Sunnis is beginning to melt. And in fact, I've seen a few articles in the newspapers over the past few days that talk about how the Saudis and the Iranians are now talking to each other. And this is a case, obviously, of Sunnis and Shia coming together. And why are they coming together? Because they are so distressed, so outraged by what is happening in Israel, that they're trying to figure out how they may work together to shut this down.
It hurts me to see that a lot of fellow seniors are not aware of this.
Yes, Medicare disadvantage. Quite a lot in the... mix. Okay. Trying to find some information about a memorial for Mark Rubel in Krannert's lobby tomorrow, and I'm not seeing it on Krannert's website. But if you can find out about that, it's supposed to be most of the afternoon. One thing unusual is that overflight rights were not given by the Sunni Saudis and the Sunni Jordanians, primarily. So I guess stealth fighters were used. So violations of airspace were included in this episode. I thought it was mostly missiles, but apparently it was stealth fighters, F-35Is. And what else can I tell you about? Oh, the Friday Forum this past week will go out Wednesday. Understanding White Christian Nationalism. It was a panel discussion that included Reverend Terrence Thomas of Bethel AME and Michael Crosby. He's a prelate, I guess I might call him, at the First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana. It followed the Thursday night screening of Bad Faith, White Christian Nationalism's Unholy War on Democracy, which is quite moving. It's on all of the premium channels. It's not on Passport or PBS. In fact, PBS's reports on the January 6th insurrection don't include a lot of the imagery of Christianity that were rampant in the crowd. I think they took over a room in the building and then prayed, one of the episodes. But Bad Faith is available on Tubi, T-U-B-I. You don't have to sign over anything much. You can sign in. It's free. You can watch that pretty riveting documentary that was discussed. And that'll be rebroadcast this coming Wednesday. Supreme Court and democracy. I was going to ask about the lower courts, too. This is a local law professor. He'll be the person presenting on the 1st of November, next Friday. Happy Halloween.
Israel businesses are closing. There are credible reports in the Israeli press that the numbers of wounded are far higher than the official statistics. As you know, because of distances, you can be grievously wounded in Gaza, put on a helicopter, and receive very sophisticated medical attention very quickly, which may save your life. But you will be debilitated for as long as you live. And then you would have to go back to the kind of the political divides that were taking place in Israel before October 7th, the kind of constitutional crisis. People, again, they hide the numbers, but estimates are as high as 500,000 Israelis have left the country since October 7th. So this has all put tremendous stress internally within Israel. Can you address that?
I agree with everything you said. And I would just add to this that you want to remember that Israel is in a protracted war that it is unable to shut down at the moment. They may pull a rabbit out of a hat and shut down these three conflicts. I would not bet a lot of money on it. But the problems you described are only going to get worse with the passage of time. I mean, first of all, the economy has been badly damaged by this war for all sorts of obvious reasons. Tourism is down. All sorts of people who operate businesses have been called up to serve in the reserves, and the businesses have shut down. Companies in the West are not investing in Israel as they once promised to do. So there are all sorts of big economic problems here. And as you point out, and not to be underestimated, there was all sorts of talk about a civil war in Israel before October 7th. This is a badly divided society that has all sorts of fundamental issues at play that haven't been resolved. And once the shooting stops in this war, those problems will rise to the surface. They've been somewhat tamped down now because Israel is involved in three wars. But those problems have not gone away. With regard to the state of the military, it's very clear that they're having trouble getting all of the reservists that they're calling up for a second, third, or fourth time to report for duty because people are just worn out and they don't want to continue serving. They have families, they have jobs, and they want to go do those things. They don't want to serve in the military. So this is a big problem for the Israelis. And as you point out, there are a good number of wounded and killed, and those numbers are only going to go up with the passage of time. So this is a society that is in real trouble. It has all sorts of cleavages inside it. Centrifugal forces is the word I like to use. And once this is over with and people take stock of what has happened, I think the situation is going to be mighty grim. You know, a lot of what's going on now is happening so fast that it's difficult for all of us to take stock of it. But at some point when the shooting stops, we're going to take stock of what has happened. People are going to write articles. They're going to write books. They're going to produce documentaries. And the story that people are going to tell about Israel and how it has behaved is going to be blood-curdling. It's just amazing what horrors the Israelis have been inflicting on the Palestinians. And of course, we see some evidence of this because it's all thoroughly documented. But once the war stops and people have an opportunity to sit back and think about it in a more careful way, I think the consequences for Israel and the consequences for the United States, especially the Biden administration, are going to be great. If I can just want to add one point to this, as you well know, Chris, we have in the United States this huge human rights community that prides itself on privileging human rights and making the argument that the United States should pursue a liberal foreign policy that supports liberal values and supports human rights. Where has this community been since October 7th? Where is this community when all these horrors are taking place in Gaza? When in fact a genocide is taking place in Gaza, they're all basically AWOL. They're not there. Where is this human rights community? It's really quite shocking to me the extent to which people in liberal America and liberal Europe have remained silent, if not complicitous, in this genocide in Gaza.
The historian Ilan Pappi is saying potentially Israel as a Zionist entity won't exist within 3 years. Is that a prediction you think is plausible?
No, I don't think so. I think Israel will be around for the foreseeable future. It's very hard to tell what its future looks like. I think that when this war ends, that huge numbers of secular Israelis will leave and go to Europe or go to the United States. I think that they will, number one, recognize the centrifugal forces at play inside the society, and that they will understand full well that the balance of power between secular forces and more religious and right-wing forces is steadily shifting against the secular forces and in favor of the more religious forces. I mean, people like Smotrich are not going away. Ben-Gvir, he's not going away. There are going to be more people like that in Israel in the future. And this is going to drive a lot of secular Israelis away. And the end result is, I think, Israel will become a more hawkish, a more religious state in the future than it is now. I don't think it'll go away, though. I think it'll be much harder for the United States to support Israel in those circumstances. I think the lobby will have to work harder than ever to get the United States to support this country unequivocally. But the lobby will, I think, rise to the task. And that will not be good for domestic politics in the United States. But I think that's the picture you see. And I think for the Palestinians, if you think about what is the future of the Palestinians inside of Greater Israel, and here we're talking about the Palestinians inside the Israel that was created in 1948, what we call Green Line Israel, plus Gaza and the West Bank. I think if you think about the future of the Palestinians in Greater Israel, it's a very dismal, if not categorically depressing picture. It's hard to imagine the Israelis improving their behavior toward the Palestinians. As abominable as it is now, I don't think it's going to get better with the passage of time. I think, if anything, it's going to get worse. This is a society that is in deep, deep trouble.
Let's talk about the lobby. Certainly, I've been to encampments at universities such as Columbia and Princeton. A significant percentage of the students protesting are Jewish, Jewish Voices for Peace. It's pretty clear that this next generation of Jewish men and women are not buying into the Zionist project. At the same time, the lobby has had to make pretty vast expenditures. It was $11 million they spent, something like that, to get rid of Jamal Bowman. It does appear that it's becoming increasingly an uphill battle for the lobby. Has this changed? Since the genocide, has it weakened the power of the lobby?
Well, I think what's happened here, Chris, is that there has been a fundamental change in the discourse about Israel.
It hurts me to see that a lot of fellow seniors are not aware of this completely free $3,200.
That's why it's running longer than it says it was. It's because they're dropping in all these ads. This was only dropped Wednesday, maybe. Or it was recorded Wednesday. John Mearsheimer with Chris Hedges on the Chris Hedges Report on YouTube. And they did as I suggested they were going to do, is interrupt him in the middle of a sentence this time. You can find this at Chris Hedges' report, chrishedges.org, I guess. A great producer, great voice. Like I said, he was a New York Times reporter in Israel for 4 or 5 years at least, in the war zone in the Balkans, too. I've always thought Chomsky and he should have a debate about that because they're on the other side of the issue with Chomsky's lessons from Kosovo, humanitarian military interventionism. Is that the subtitle? Why don't I drop in the underwriting announcement here just because I'm waiting for Chris Hedges and John Mearsheimer come back. Ukraine was mentioned just once in the intro, as in the fiasco in the Ukraine. He's known more about that than he is about his memory of his seminal book with Stephen Walt of Harvard on the Israel lobby. Chris Hedges said at the front end, that it's still controversial, but not dismissible as it was in those days. Okay, guess I'm ready to go. Radio Free Labor coming up. Stay around for that.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500.
I'd say when Steve and I wrote our article 2006 and then the book in 2007, I think that we played a key role, at the risk of sounding like I'm bragging, in sort of opening the discourse on Israel and on the lobby and on the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And all sorts of other people have come in and played a key role in laying out in even greater detail what Israel is up to, what the lobby is up to. So we're at a point now where the discourse has changed. The mere fact that you and I are having this conversation says a great deal about what's happened to the discourse. And as you point out quite correctly, and I always like to emphasize this, it's very important to understand that there are lots of Jews who are on the right side on this issue. You mentioned Jewish Voice for Peace. I have enormous respect for the people in Jewish Voice for Peace. And in a lot of the campus demonstrations at Columbia, at Chicago, and all sorts of other places, there were lots of Jewish students involved. So the lobby has a real problem with the discourse. There's just no question about that. But where they remain amazingly effective is at the policy level. So you now have this disjuncture between the public discourse and what's happening at the policy level. If you look at public opinion polls in the United States on, and you look at what American respondents say when they're asked whether they think Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza, you'll see that over 50% of Americans think that. And you'll see that lots of Americans don't support us, meaning the U.S. government, supporting Israel unconditionally, right? But the fact is that doesn't translate into policy, because the lobby is so deadly effective on Capitol Hill and in dealing with the executive branch. So the question you have to ask yourself is whether or not, given the shifting opinion inside the Jewish community, given what's happening in terms of the discourse, whether, you know, in the future, an American president and Congress can go along with Israel at the policy level, no matter what. And I think there is no evidence that anything has changed at that level. I think the lobby remains as powerful as ever, if not more powerful, in terms of influencing the actual U.S. policy.
Let's end by talking about Iran, all the ways this could go wrong. Iran, you referred to Iran's response. It was telegraphed in advance. I mean, one could call it even choreographed,
yes.
The first response. The second response, less so, but there was, I think there was a Palestinian who was wounded, but there weren't large numbers of casualties, and one has to believe that was intentional. But how could you see this playing out in a way that essentially creates a conflagration that we get sucked into, and what would that look like?
That's a nice question to leave hanging in the air. You want to hear that? Obviously, it was recorded before the attack that happened. Stealth bombers. And probably a lot of missiles, too. I've been trying to find out more details. But, you know, it was released beforehand, too, actually, what they were putting together. With that release of those documents. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting.